From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
This executive order was mean-spirited and un-American.
That was New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer this past weekend at a press conference where he condemned President Trump's executive order issued last Friday, which suspends the acceptance of refugees from Syria for 120 days and adds an extra level of scrutiny to people coming into the country on visas from seven countries that have been designated by previous administrations as state sponsors of terrorism. He characterized the executive order as a Muslim ban.
It was implemented in a way that created chaos and confusion across the country, and it will only serve to embolden and inspire those around the globe who will do us harm. It must be reversed immediately. Senate Democrats are going to introduce legislation to overturn this and move it as quickly as we can. And I, as your senator from New York, will claw, scrap, and fight with every fiber of my being until these orders are overturned.
Schumer was one of the most hawkish Democrats in the Senate during the Iraq War vote in October of 2002. At that time, he displayed an entirely different emotional state.
I think this is how the Senate ought to work and ought to be. And I think this is a fine day for the Senate. Saddam Hussein is an evil man, a dictator who oppresses his people and flouts the mandate of the international community. While this behavior is reprehensible, it is Hussein's vigorous pursuit of biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons, and his present and future potential support for terrorist acts and organizations that make him a danger to the people of the United States. By empowering the president to use force, we will send a message to both Hussein and the nations of the world that the threat of force is real and that we are serious about disarming him. Should we go to war, the president must see that we don't lose our vigilance in other aspects of the war on terrorism, apart from Iraq, both abroad and at home. Al-Qaeda and other groups will continue to target our citizens. We must not let down our guard. Countries like Syria and Iran will continue to aid and abet terrorists. We must keep a watchful eye. The president and the Secretary of Defense have assured us that if war becomes necessary, our military can launch a successful invasion of Iraq without compromising these efforts. In addition, if there is a war in Iraq, we must not let it diminish our efforts to make our own homeland more secure. Our airports and seaports, rail lines, nuclear facilities, and our communications infrastructure all remain unacceptably vulnerable. I have been quite critical of the administration on this point, Mr. President, and urge them again to refocus their efforts. We are about to spend billions of dollars to reduce threats abroad. We should spend similar amounts of money to safeguard ourselves here at home.
15 years later, the most reliable estimates show about 1 million Iraqis having been killed, many more millions homeless, and reduced to either internal or external refugee status. New York Democratic Representative Gerald Nadler also strongly condemned President Trump's executive order regarding the visas this past weekend.
The executive order signed by President Trump is discriminatory, discriminatory on religion, and frankly quite disgusting. Not a single terrorist incident since before 9/11 has been caused by anyone from any of the seven countries that the president named.
Again, those seven countries: Iraq, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen made the list under previous administrations. They were named in the executive order, with the exception of Syria, only by reference to prior legislation. This was Nadler on the floor of the House back in 2010 after Israel killed 9 Turks, including 1 American citizen, on the high seas. They were peace activists seeking to bring food and medical supplies to the besieged people of Gaza.
It has been absolutely galling to watch the hypocrisy directed at, and the fury, the undeserved fury directed at Israel for taking its steps in its own self-defense.
And late Monday, it was reported that a spokesperson for former President Barack Obama also criticized the executive order issued by President Trump over the weekend. For more on all of that, we spoke with our regular political commentator, Professor Tony Montero, from Philadelphia via Skype Tuesday.
I think Barack Obama is now outdoing himself in his weighing in, encouraging people to stand up and demonstrate, when in fact the policy that that the Trump forces are continuing and really implementing is under laws passed under the Obama administration by Congress and signed by him. So this is a great demonstration of moral duplicity, which is aided and abetted by the corporate media.
So you have this executive memorandum, which for the 90-day period, as far as the visas go, adds a layer of, inconvenience, difficulty to people seeking to come into the United States on visas from the 7 countries. And then 120-day suspension of accepting refugees from Syria. Now, the fighting in Syria has stopped. There's been a ceasefire in place that the Russians and Iranians and Turks brokered and guaranteed. And Trump has promised that the U.S. policy there is no longer going to be aimed at regime change. In other words, no longer attacking the Syrian government and the areas under the control of the Syrian government, but rather dealing with ISIS and Al-Qaeda, which means not generating refugees, at least in the same numbers that were being generated up to and including January 19th. It seems that if you were going to have the conditions for a moratorium on accepting refugees, that this might be the optimum time for that. And no one is putting it into the context of, you know, who the refugees are fleeing and what they're fleeing and who's creating the conditions that they're fleeing.
Yeah, I mean, look, we've been saying this over the months. And it's been clear, and anyone that doesn't see it doesn't want to see it. Trump's foreign policy is to the left of the neocons. That's what all the upset is about. His foreign policy in Syria is that we are not committing to the overthrow of Assad. That is a 180-degree turn from the Obama administration. So say what you will about this temporary ban on visas and refugees coming to the country, and I'm not completely convinced of its righteousness, of its rightfulness, but in the larger picture, in terms of Syria, his foreign policy is to the left. In fact, it undermines the anti-Assad, anti-Russian policies that preceded him and which would have been continued under the Hillary Clinton administration. The question ultimately becomes, not just what Schumer and Nadler said some years ago in terms of Turkish citizens killed or in terms of the war in Iraq, but what they said only a couple of years ago about Syria. This is the key thing. And Schumer's crocodile tears has to do not with Syrian or Muslim immigrants or travelers to the United States or visa holders or non-visa holders, but has everything to do with the fact that his policy or their policy is now being undermined by the so-called right-wing anti-Muslim, and I put quotes around that, Donald Trump. That's what this thing is all about. And so on. That's what I just say that, man.
Yeah. So, all right. So back to what we have to try to figure out, the question of what is to be done. You have, at least at the head of the news coverage and also from the way these seem organized, the people at the microphone at the rallies, you have these people that have this history who serve these interests that have actually created these conditions in the first place. And the people who are opposed to the wrongs that have been done and that they perceive are being done now to people in Syria and elsewhere, in the streets and behind them. Assuming that, and I'm sure that this is true with, with many of the people who are showing up, that their intentions are, genuine and heartfelt and, aimed at ending the abuse of people and making lives of refugees more bearable. How do you unpack them from the condition that they're in now, which is essentially being framed as, even by them, opposition to someone that's trying to put an end to those conditions?
Well, first of all, these mobilizations are not so spontaneous as a lot of people want us to believe. Certainly, the corporate media wants us to believe. They are in places, especially cities, that are controlled by the Democratic Party. And as we know, the Democratic Party made huge investments politically and financially in these big cities for Hillary Clinton. So when you get a Mayor de Blasio leading the demonstration, or Chuck Schumer at JFK, or encouraging people to march, or Barack Obama encouraging people to march, well, you have to look at who is behind all of this. The other thing is that so many of these people see the world through the lens of CNN and MSNBC and the corporate media. There is not an alternative set of facts. And I know that that's often a pejorative term these days. But when I say alternative facts, more information than they have available to them. For example, the very thing that they ultimately want is a different policy in the Middle East. That's what they want. They want an end to war in the Middle East. But they cannot see that Trump's policy is a step in that direction. The other thing is that mixed up in all of this is the anti-Putin narrative. So they feel, a lot of them, that the election was stolen, that the election was hacked, that Trump is not a legitimate president. They feel that whatever he does is illegitimate. And they can't see, and a lot of them do not want to see what else is going on, the larger picture. So we got a very, very profound problem of the political education of a lot of these people who are under the leadership of the neoliberal managerial class. Many of them are a part of that elite. But the positive thing is that there are tens of millions of people out here that are not going along with what is so transparently a redo of the election or a delegitimation of the person who won the election, no matter what he does.
Yeah, and when you speak of tens of millions of people, you've got the 60 or so million people that voted for Trump, the tens of millions of people that voted for Sanders and the perhaps 100 million people who didn't vote at all.
And and what did they vote for?
They voted against, they voted against more of the same.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the people in the street objectively are marching for more of the same, sadly, whether it is intentional or not. And of course, when you get, what is this, Tom Kaine? Is that his name?
Tim Kaine
and Schumer and Nadler. These are major war hawks along with Obama. I mean, what are you a part of? And now we see on social media people talking about we have to separate ourselves from the liberals. Well, first of all, a lot of the so-called left that joined these marches said they're joining them to peel off some of the liberals and bring them over to their parties, to their organizations. Well, the sad news is that you are failing, and in fact, you are being peeled off and becoming a part of the liberal, neoliberal, neocon movement that wants to reestablish the policies of the Obama-Clinton years, which are policies of war that led to the refugee crisis, which has led to the problems of the destruction of the states in Libya and Iraq and Syria and other places throughout the Middle East. So I think that's what we're dealing with. Fortunately, the vast majority of the working masses have not moved in sync with the East and West Coast neoliberals. That's the positive thing.
You know, also, we've seen flare-ups of this happening since the election, certainly. Even before, there were these same voices saying they were going to shut down the RNC. And they came to the RNC, and the organizers were there, but they hadn't successfully organized anybody to line up behind them. And so there were no protests, with the exception of that guy from the Revolutionary Communist Party trying to light a flag on fire and ending up lighting himself on fire. That was about the extent of the protests in Cleveland. In Philadelphia, the protests were massive, but for some reason, unlike at airports where I have to take my shoes off, where Cynthia McKinney has to spend 4 or 5 hours every time she goes through one, 1,000 people can walk in and take the place over at dozens of them at the same time. You know, there are a lot of very odd facts nested in this story that don't make any sense to me at all if the official narrative is to be believed, and that is that this is some spontaneous uprising of the left.
Yeah, well, it's certainly not the left. Even if it is spontaneous, it's not the left. You know, one of the things that's so apparent is that Cleveland is not New York. Cleveland is in the center of the Rust Belt, the deindustrialized Rust Belt. New York is the, quote, city on the hill for the neoliberal elites. The East Coast is kind of ground zero for the Democratic Party. That's where its base has been concentrated. That's why they can't win elections. Right. It's an East and West Coast big city phenomenon, right, you know? So even the demonstrations at the Democratic National Convention here in Philadelphia, in a lot of ways, could be attributable to the fact of where the convention was held.
Well, also, and they couldn't get within, as you recall, literally, you couldn't get within a mile of the convention site, unlike these airports, which were suddenly open for occupation.
Absolutely. That's another thing. Yes, yes. So, yeah, but I think we're looking at a serious class division here. The demonstrators representing one and being populated by one social class, and that's pretty much the petty bourgeoisie, which are predisposed to the liberal mantras of the Democratic Party, even though many of them say that's not what we're doing. In fact, that's what is happening. And this vast working class, including now, interestingly, the leadership of the AFL-CIO, the Steelworkers Union, the Teamsters, and the building trades. I mean, this coalescing around Trump's program for infrastructure development of the labor movement is not to be taken lightly, because overwhelmingly the labor movement, its leadership, was with Hillary Clinton in the last election. And in a matter of days of Trump's inauguration, they are with him, at least on the substantive issues. And I think this is what we have to take seriously. Why is the working class, at least at the, well, not just at the leadership level, but what we saw in the polling after the election, why is the working class not following the neoliberals and the Democratic Party leadership in these demonstrations? Another thing I think we need to take seriously is, while Elizabeth Warren marched in Boston, and of course Chuck Schumer in New York, and Tim Kaine in Virginia, Bernie Sanders is not a part of these marches. Now, say what you want about Bernie Sanders, and I have a lot to say about him. The fact of the matter is that Bernie Sanders has made it clear that if the Democratic Party is to become credible and to become viable going forward, it has to return to its former working class base. That's what Bernie Sanders is saying. And I think he might understand that these demonstrators and these demonstrations are part of taking the party back. It's a part of a takeover of the party by the corporate neoliberal establishment that led to the debacle of November 8th.
So, you know, we saw this big announcement of all the big action that was going to be at the RNC. They were going to shut it down and shut down Trump. That failed. We saw the big push after the Democratic convention for unity, quote unquote, stronger together and all that, even as they dissed the Sanders delegates. That failed. We saw the hysteria reaching a huge peak right before the election, that Trump was going to be Hitler the day after tomorrow, and all of that. That failed. We saw the effort to discredit him at the Electoral College and at the certification of the Electoral College. All of that failed. The attempt to delegitimize him at the inauguration, that failed. He gets to sit down with people from the unions, and this starts to coalesce, and Sanders makes affirmative statements in the aftermath of that, and almost immediately now this push that talks about a Muslim ban that doesn't exist, for example. That doesn't seem to be headed anywhere either, and yet we are seeing this division in the working class that must be dealt with as we enter this condition of growing condition of crisis. How do we get there?
Well, yes, all of the Stop Trump efforts have failed, and this is going to fail. It's going to fizzle out because it is not anchored in a social base that is durable, and it doesn't have alternative politics that makes sense to anybody. Look, here in Philadelphia, Philadelphia is almost a 50% black city, and if you add Latinos and Asians, I would say that Philadelphia is more, is closer to almost 60% people of color. Look at the demonstrators at Philadelphia's International Airport. They're all white. You know, how do you account for the actual demographics of Philadelphia and the participants in the marches being so different? I think the fact of the matter is that working people and black Philadelphia, which is almost the same, don't feel this, don't feel Hillary, are not encouraged by the moral duplicity of Barack Obama. In fact, many of them consciously rejected him in the last election. I think on the economic issues, which of course are not enough to build the type of unity that is ultimately necessary, but on the economic issues, working people are closer today than they have been for many, many decades. And that, by that I mean the unity of the working class across the color line. Now, issues and problems have to be solved. We have to get the immigration question straight. Trump's position on immigration, that is from South America and Mexico, is wrong. Don't punish the immigrants. Address the problems that produced immigration. And he has not done that. But on the questions of these global trade pacts, TPP, TIPP, NAFTA, and on the other side of it, infrastructure development, those are issues that address the crisis of everyday living of working people, and working people will respond to that. The question is whether or not the trade union leadership can get out in front of the working class itself, or let me put it this way, out in front of what is a rank and file working class rebellion against the leadership of the trade union movement. Can it get out in front of its rank and file and not just rely upon Trump, but come forward with a program that is a working class program to address the crisis of unemployment and poverty that's affecting the majority, the overwhelming majority of working people? And then, of course, when you take the social issues, such as public education, such as health care, etc., what we need is a independent working class movement which is not just responding to Trump, but putting something on the table to which Trump must respond to. Now, the last thing I would say, Don, people like to talk about Republicans and Democrats. Well, it's obvious for anybody that wants to see it that most of the leaders of the Republican Party, especially in the Senate, will be in opposition to Trump. Trump will have to build a base independent of both of the two parties. That was begun with these meetings with trade union leaders and such. But the Republican Party, as we have known it, will cease to exist. We will see it implode in the next few months. It's begun that, the John McCain's and Lindsey Graham's, there'll be others. So there is a lot happening, assembling of the old political order, and we are on the cusp of the birth of something new.
Professor Montero, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.